If it pleases the court, may it please the court, opposing counsel, Mr. Ruffner. This case has been before the court. Your Honor wrote the opinion where we made an effort on behalf of Louise Coberdance to remove the guardian ad litems. The court affirmed the trial court as far as the removal. The amount of attorney fees had not been determined, so it was sent back without prejudice for that to happen. The amount of the attorney fees and costs that were determined as what the trial court considered groundless, frivolous, and vexatious were $30,000. About $10,000 of that was costs. To give you a little bit of background on how this evolved, which I think fits into things, I brought this matter to remove the guardians in about April of 2008. The guardians were Colleen Carmichael and a son-in-law, Frank Carmichael, who live in Joplin, Missouri. They are guardians of Gregory Coberdance, who's now 50 years of age, developmentally disabled. I think about the equivalent of a 7-year-old. There was really no action in this case from about 1994, 1995 till 2008. And now I believe that the registry of action was printed out. There's probably over 1,500 pages, as there has been a horrible family warfare. In 1995, Colleen and Frank were made the guardians with all the family approving it, apparently so that Gregory could get health insurance, although that's kind of questionable with Medicaid being available. The same attorney represented all the parties in the family, all signed off on it. There was a visitor's report which said basically that what was being done for this reason, that Gregory would live with his mother, she would make the day-to-day decisions, and that she has done for 50 years. I'm digressing in that was not, there was not any endorsement of that comment on the letters, so the letters were unrestricted. In about 2008, Mrs. Coberdance became aware that there seemed to be a move afoot of the Carmichaels to have Gregory moved for long periods of time or for a substantial period of time to Missouri.
Mr. Hill, it seems to me that you're effectively trying to re-argue the merits of the case, and how can we find that the trial court abused its discretion when in the prior appeal, a division of this court said that there was no basis for the removal, or it affirmed the trial court's decision not to remove the guardians?
And I'm not arguing that. I know what the prior decision was. It was to not remove the guardians. And the issue, the trial court made a finding that Mrs. Coberdance's actions were frivolous, groundless, and vexatious. In the course of the proceedings after the petition for removal was filed, Mrs. Coberdance testified only once when she was in the hospital with a fractured femur. In about May of 2008, not wanting Gregory to be away too long in Missouri, she recuperated. And there was an argument over that, but he went back to Missouri and stayed there until the fall. and then came back. Mrs. Culbertance said in substance at that meeting that he was her medicine, that she didn't like what the guardians were doing now. They were good at brainwashing him. That was really her own only testimony. And about September or October, I was asked to leave as counsel. I appeared then pro bono. I appear now pro bono. I had a foul up on a hearing date. I withdrew. Spencer Crona came in, tried the case, put on the evidence of Dr. Spiegel, which was the only evidence that he put on, and he rested. And after that, there was a 41B motion, which was later ruled on in 2009, denying the petition to remove the guardians, but making an effort to put restrictions and controls on the guardians, in part following quite a bit of the GAL recommendations. In Dr. Spiegel's report, Dr. Spiegel had interviewed most of the people. There's 13 people in the family. Gregory is, I think, the youngest. At the time, the alignment was roughly seven out-of-state people, or seven people that were supporting the guardians, and five that were supporting the mother. And that's kind of switched around the family dynamics. The ones out of state are Colleen and Teresa and Deborah, Brother Joe in Michigan, and Kathy Owen in Castle Rock. So again, the dynamics switched around. Dr. Spiegel interviewed Mr. Ruffner. He interviewed Kathy Owens, the guardian, the guardians.
Mother got, and as I recall, I, in opinion, said she got most everything she wanted in terms of access to her son, and her son being in Colorado.
Her son was to stay in Colorado. The order specifically said he was to stay in Colorado. Right about that same time, we have a statute that was passed. I can't give you the name of it, a uniform statute that I think allows you to change residency of a ward if they've been, if they've resided somewhere else 6 months. But you're correct, the mother did not get the removal of the guardians, which was very important. There were restrictions placed on the guardians. Gregory was not to be, not to have his residency changed from Colorado.
We're here to address whether mother's efforts to remove the guardians were based upon allegations that were frivolous grounds.
That's correct. And the trial court made comment about that there was a failure to investigate, that the mother seemed to be cheerleading for others, that she was seemed to be trying to prove a point. And I've mentioned to you the only testimony of the mother, and I was not, there were no affidavits from me, no depositions were taken of any party. And those statements were made by the trial court, in my opinion, in the absence of any support, that the mother did anything but bring her petition where she thought it was then in the best interest of Gregory to change the guardians. Now, since I filed my brief, and I thought I had done this, but I noticed that where the talk is reviewing for where the trial court has discretion, there are at least two Colorado cases that suggest the trial court's reasoning will be reviewed de novo, which I believe should be done here. The mother did not do anything other than what I have told you in testifying from the hospital. Mr. Crona, when he put on Dr. Spiegel's report, in it, in addition to interviewing the mother, Gregory, Mr. Ruffner, Colleen, Frank, Kathy noted that there had been the failure to sign consents by the guardian to get some community services. If you look at the trial court order, the trial court ordered that. Trial court also noted that since about 2001, well, there had not been any reports filed, and our JDF form now has really very thoughtful, thorough requirements as to what the guardians are doing for the benefit of the ward. No such report was filed until after this was tried in the fall of 2008. So,
is it your intention here that, despite the fact Mother made allegations of malfeasance at the time the action was commenced, she didn't pursue them, and in fact withdrew them?
That's what Mr. Crona said on the morning when he went forward with Dr. Spiegel's report by testimony and introducing the report. But he and we would be allowed to plead in the alternative, and in the entire record there was nothing that fits with Colorado case law that suggests that those allegations were frivolous, groundless, or vexatious.
Well, she didn't pursue them. My question would be, at this point, is there anything identifiable in the billing of counsel by which you could separate out the vexatious claims from what remained to be tried?
I believe not. The efforts were made, and they were made by Mr. Furman in Fort Morgan. Counsel basically did block billing, and the depositions were taken of an expert and of Mr. Ruffner, and my answer would be no. There was not a way that you could effectively separate that out, and what the trial court seemed to do, in my opinion, was just make a guesstimate that some amount should be allowed for these allegations that he deemed without merit or frivolous, groundless, frivolous, and vexatious. So I think, and in the cost, there's a substantial amount for travel and for lodging. I believe there's a case that says that in some cases that's appropriate, but I think there's around $5,000 or so that was allowed there on the costs. And I believe that the record would show that this was about a one-day hearing. There was a lot of time that these guardians stayed in Sterling where battles went on as to how long Gregory would be in Missouri. The final thing is that trial court criticized the mother for it not being brought up that Gregory spent time in Missouri. And in the record, that shows from the very beginning that it was talked about. It wasn't hidden. It wasn't a secret. He visited. He vacationed there. On occasion, he'd gone there with his mother. So to suggest that should have been brought up by counsel early, it's not true. It was discussed early. It was part of what was talked about in May.
In your opening brief, did you challenge the cost award separately from the fee award?
Pardon?
In your opening brief, did you challenge the cost award?
The opening brief challenged the total award of $30,000.
Didn't make any argument in the opening brief about too much traveling, too much lodging expense.
I don't believe it separated out those two items.
Yeah, if afternoon. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Rick Ruffner, appearing here on behalf of the Guardians Appellees in this case. As this court noted in the opinion offered by Judge Roy in April of 2010, when we're dealing with a standard of review that is an abuse of discretion, which I believe that we both cited in our briefs is the appropriate standard, that this court will only reverse the trial court's decision based upon an erroneous application of the law or is otherwise manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. I assert to you that as we've stated in our brief and what the record shows and what Judge Singer's well-reasoned opinion shows, this case was manifestly arbitrary in its pursuit.
Counsel, would you agree that you're only entitled to attorney's fees for those claims that were vexatious?
I agree with that.
Now,
or groundless and frivolous, right. That entails the concept of vexatious.
Just throw it into one word. Okay. Counsel seems to indicate that we can't separate out what went to the claims of malfeasance and what went to the claims that were ultimately tried. Why is that?
I have two responses. First of all, the record before Judge Singer clearly showed what was attributed to malfeasance in my sworn testimony by way of deposition that was submitted to Judge Singer. He considered all of that testimony along with the voluminous pleadings and other court appearances that the parties had in front of him.
What were your total fees?
My total fees and costs that I claimed were
$89,000. So only $30,000.
And only $21,000 in fees. So I claimed approximately $79,000 in fees. Judge Singer did two things with those. And although I might have disagreed with him and do disagree with him, they certainly were within his discretion to do it. One, he reduced the lodestar factor of my fee from my billing rate of 250 down to 175, going through a number of factors as to why he did that. Number two, he evaluated all the claims and the extent of the litigation, which was geared towards defense of the malfeasance claims, which is what we had in the case and only had in the case up to the morning of the hearing, 10 months after the litigation was commenced. So Judge Singer went through all of those and decided that, in essence, I was only entitled to $21,000 in attorney's fees rather than the $79,000 had been claimed.
Mr. Buckner, but what was the basis for the trial court's 40% reduction? Why can't we say that there should be a 50% reduction or a 60% reduction?
He went through the totality of circumstances and looked at all of the pleadings. He, of course, had the hearing that did occur in December 2008, which was part of those same fees. And he had all of the other hearings that we had in front of him for various things. There was a restraining order involved with keeping the guardians from taking Gregory back to Missouri. He deemed that that was not appropriate. And when he went through all of the case and evaluated how much of the case was related to the malfeasance assertions, which then there was no evidence ever even attempted to be presented, he determined that that reduction should be made. And that was an appropriate exercise of his discretion in his very thorough analysis of it. Matter of fact, I've had few judges that have analyzed it as thoroughly as he did, but that was his decision. The guardians had argued that up until the morning of hearing, there never was any claim but a claim of malfeasance for removing the guardians. And it was only on the morning of hearing, and if you look at the beginning of the transcript of the morning of the hearing, counsel for Louise Cloverdance withdrew the claims of malfeasance, to my shock and surprise. And as I think that my irritation with that showed loudly and clearly in the record. Up to that point in time, all of the litigation had been geared in some fashion towards defending that the guardians had not committed malfeasance. And only that. The issue of family turmoil was not raised as the basis for removal of the guardians until the morning of the hearing. Indeed, in the pleadings filed by Mr. Hill on behalf of Louise Cloverdance, back at the beginning of the case, he clearly stated, and it's in addendum E to the opening brief, In the reply to Guardian's response and opposition to the petition for removal, he clearly stated in paragraph 10, the many issues within the family are not the issue regarding removal. So it wasn't the family turmoil issue at all. The only time that even came out was when Dr. Spiegel, 6 weeks before the hearing, issued a report in which he made that comment as being in the best interest. At not one point up to that time had that ever even been mentioned as the reason for the petition for removal. And then, as I say, on the morning of hearing, that's the only basis that they went forward on. And as the court has already indicated, the bases for denying the petition for removal were well considered by Judge Singer before and considered on appeal in April of 2010. So the issue here is there anything that shows that the court abused its discretion in analyzing those attorney's fees, analyzing case before it, and determining that 60% of the case related to defense of the malfeasance and misconduct claims on behalf of the guardians, for which there never was any evidence. Indeed, even in the appeal here, in the opening brief and the reply brief, Louise Colbert-Ance is still arguing the malfeasance on behalf of the guardians. And this just shows you how the litigation was groundless and vexatious. And I'll give you just
how old a woman is Ms. Colbert-Ance?
She's, I believe, 93 now. She's certainly in her early 90s. And there are other pleadings presently pending regarding that issue, whether she is still capable.
Well, we have another appeal in this matter pending, as I understand it.
That's on a contempt citation, yes. Yes, yes. But with regard to the, I lost my train of thought. With regard to the issue of just showing how claims were made of malfeasance and attempted to be relied upon, but never had any basis or any evidence, even in the briefs here, Louise Colbert-Ance continues to argue that the guardians failed to file an annual report. And that should be a basis for withdrawal of the guardians. And I'm only using this as just one example. That's an act of malfeasance we had to defend up until the morning of the hearing. They continue to make that assertion. There was never any obligation for such an annual report to be filed. The statutes were modified in 2001, 5 years after the guardians were appointed, now calling for guardians to file an annual report. 1514.317 is the section. However, that same legislative act also implemented 1517.103, which clearly states that unless and until a court enters additional orders, there is no requirement. There is no requirement for an annual report to be filed. Ultimately, Judge Singer ordered that annual reports now be filed. That's been complied with ever since. But it just shows the vexatious and groundless nature of the claims that were made throughout and continue to be made to this day. It was difficult in reading the opening brief, and indeed even in listening to the comments today, as to what the appellant's real argument is. I can't tell because they have not set forth in their brief, they've not set forth today, where Judge Singer abused his discretion, where he was wrong in his findings. All that they have said is that they had a basis for removal of the guardian because of the family turmoil and best interests of Gregory. Because Judge Singer gave them the benefit of the doubt on that the morning of hearing, he also then did not award all of our attorney's fees. He factored that in. Yet that continues to be the basis, apparently, as best I can understand it, of saying that the court abused its discretion.
How do you address the, the current objection to the cost, the travel costs that were awarded?
No objection was ever made at the trial court, for one thing. The cost portion, the $10,000 plus portion of the claim that was part of our affidavits wherein we set forth not only the attorney's fees but also all the out-of-pocket expenses were never contested. And certainly they have not been an issue on appeal here. The Judge Singer found those to be appropriate costs under the Cherry Creek School District case. I can't give the site, but that's the seminal case on what costs are appropriate. Those costs were never contested. And so initially Judge Singer erred. And to his credit, when I filed a Rule 59 motion for reconsideration, he had awarded costs based upon this same formula. And I pointed out that costs were not based upon a ratio of frivolous to the non-frivolous claims. Costs go to the prevailing party. He did determine we were the prevailing party, and he thus then awarded all the costs. And he stated in his reissued order that I was correct in that and the court was wrong, and reconsidered the costs. In closing, if this court cannot find that Judge Singer abused his discretion, even if the decision of this court might have been different in its analysis of the facts, this court cannot change the orders of Judge Singer. And for those reasons, and for the reasons we set forth in our brief, I would ask for the decision to be affirmed.
Are you also seeking fees on appeal?
We are. On what frivolous appeal?
So you're contending the appeal, is separately frivolous?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My recollection is that the costs and the fees were objected to in total. I don't have that with me, but I don't think it's correct that there was no objection to costs and fees. What we're asking is that, or what we believe is shown, is that there was not groundless, frivolous, or vexatious litigation, and that there are not findings supported by anything in the record. And I'd like to supplement and file the two cases that say you may review de novo the court's reasoning, because I believe the court just out of thin air said that she was cheerleading, that she was trying to gain prove a point. And there is nothing in the record to show anything like that. And I'll also ask, and I know I looked back before, I think if you look at my original petition, that it is not a correct statement that the whole emphasis there was on misfeasance. I believe the general thrust of the petition for removal was that it was in the best interest of Gregory.
That concludes the argument. We thank counsel for the and the argument. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.
Thank you.